Well, fellas, thanks for coming on my podcast.
Thanks for having
Senator
us.
Senator Tom Daschle, Senator Trent Lott. I got a lot of power here. Well, it was powerful at one time. I'm
Once
not sure how much horsepower you got left.
Yep. That's right.
But majority leader, Democrat, majority leader Republican.
Yes, sir.
And I thought you guys were all pals. I mean, you know, that it's just, it's a club, isn't it, really? And that's what you call the Senate.
Well, it should be, and it was with us. We developed quite a strong relationship, and I think that helped us get things done through some tough times that we talk about.
I think you need, Trent and I talk a lot about the need for chemistry. You got to have chemistry to be able to work together to, you know, to try to find some common ground on some of the big issues we're facing. And I, unfortunately today, I don't think you see a lot of chemistry. And
there's
Well, I think a lot of different reasons. The House and the Senate have gone back and forth several times, and so there's a competitive, you don't want to help the other side get either into the majority or stay in the majority. That's part of it. Part of it is the media has changed a lot. It used to be the media was the referee. Now they're the participants.
The media, to me, wants to decide who's going to.
Exactly.
And I truly believe that.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, no question.
Now, this media, my media is not that way. I'm trying to work my way into the big time.
But one of the main things that Tom makes a point of most of the time is he describes the biggest problem in Washington as the airplane. Because it's gotten where it's too easy for members to come and go. They don't bring their families up here. They, a lot of them sleep in their offices. They work a day and a half, 2 days, maybe a week, you know, and they don't even sync their schedules. The House is in, the Senate's out, or vice versa. So that is, they don't really know each other the way we knew each other. We used to socialize together. Our families knew each other. That has really had a profound impact.
But Trent, both you guys live up here.
Yes, sir, and we did. We brought our families up here. I kept my home back in Mississippi.
I
was right on the Gulf of Mexico until Katrina washed my house away. I knew if I sold
that
house.
Well, you're from Aberdeen.
Aberdeen, yep.
South Dakota. But where in
Pascagoula, Mississippi, shipbuilding community. My dad was a pipe fitter in a shipyard.
The big big refinery there.
Yes, sir. We've got a Chevron refinery there, one of the biggest in the country.
What is that, 300,000 barrels a day?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah,
it's big. Right. You seem to know a little bit about oil and gas.
Listen, I've been in oil and gas. Thanks again for coming on with me today and all. And let's talk about Crisis Point. You guys wrote this book together. Kind of surprised me when I saw that.
Yeah.
And then after I thought about it, it didn't surprise me that much. I mean, I can see why you would write it together because you came upon the subject, I guess, from a little bit different.
Sure. We're philosophically, Tom and I didn't always agree. We still don't, but didn't mean we had to be disagreeable.
That's right.
And we had a lot of important issues that we had to find a way to get them done.
But you know, it's a little bit like how you probably feel about oil and gas. You care deeply about it. You've got a passion. You've been very successful at it. You know, this is our passion. It's governance and how you figure out a way to make this Democratic Republic work as good as it can. And we think we have reached a crisis point where Washington is so dysfunctional today that many of the major challenges we face as a country are going unattended just because of the polarization and confrontation. So we wrote the book saying, you know, we didn't get everything right, and this isn't about us. But we learned a few things that we think might be applicable and have some ideas that we'd like to share, and that's really what the book does.
Well, do these guys listen to you that are in there now?
Well, just like last night, we had dinner with the Senate Chiefs of Staff and Legislative Directors. Now, these are men and women that are right there next to the senators and help them and work with them. And so we talked about the book and some of the experiences we had. And it was an attentive audience. We challenged them to help their senators to find ways to work together more and to find ways to move legislation. We even suggested amending some rules.
Those are not the people that are making the decision.
No, they're not, but they're very important.
I understand.
Yeah.
Listen, I know where I'd be if I didn't have a good staff. They can make you look good or they can make you look bad. But tell me, though, after you talk to them, they, I know, will know more than they knew before you had the dinner, okay? But are they going to have influence?
I think they will. I mean, these are very senior members. And I made the point right at the beginning that I was able to be the majority leader in the Senate because I had such a great staff. I knew the people back in Mississippi were being looked after. they help me in so many ways. And in many respects, a senator is only as good as his or her staff that help you control your schedule and deal with the issues. But we still talk to our former colleagues. They don't necessarily ask our advice.
Now we're getting there.
You know, just like on this book, my wife and I were at Tom's house with he and his wife, and we got to talking about our concerns and what we went through. But I want to emphasize a point he made. This was a lot of history in there about, oh, look, it's not new to have difficulties in governing in America. It goes back to the beginning. And then we talked about some of the things we had to deal with, like the impeachment trial, the 50-50 Senate, and how we were able to still get a balanced budget and telecommunications reform.
Why can't they get that now? Why can't you get a balanced budget?
Well, I think there are a lot of issues. Partly it's because there's a disagreement on how you go about getting it. I mean, Democrats feel that there's a need for revenue and a need for cuts, and that you ought to do both. That's how we've done it in the past. When Trent and I were leaders, we got three balanced budgets in a row, and there was revenue on the table and cuts on the table, and that's how we got there. And then economic growth. We need a lot more economic growth. We're doing a little bit better.
I'm going to help you on that one in just a minute.
Well, one other thing, too, I want to get this, and I don't mean it as a criticism of the present situation. It's a compliment of the president, the presidency. We worked with Clinton and with George W. while we were in leadership positions. They reached out to us. They talked to us. They worked with us. You can't get a balanced budget without Congress and the president. And that dynamic is not there now.
No, that's right. Well, they're not. That's part of the... We talked earlier about chemistry. There isn't any chemistry between the President and the Congress, between Republicans and Democrats, and even between the House and the Senate. There just isn't that kind of interaction and that kind of integration that comes with normal relationship building. That doesn't happen anymore, in part because people aren't in town, in part because there's so much competition for who's going to be in the majority, in part because everybody's out there raising a whole lot of money.
But you're saying that wasn't there when you guys were...
Not to the degree it is now. No.
Okay. All didn't really care who had the majority, did you?
Oh, we cared.
Oh, yeah, sure we did. In fact, I like to tell the story, it may be in the book, about one time I went over to Tom on his side of the Senate chamber. I said, Tom, you know if we get this done, it's going to be right for the country. It's going to be plenty of credit to go around for you and for me and for us and for you and your people. Well, he got so much credit, they got the majority. So, see, I made a mistake about until we get this done, it'll be good for everybody. Well, it was good for him.
It was just two guys working together.
That's right.
We presided over the first 50-50 Senate when there wasn't any clear majority in 2000, and that was tough working out, too.
Of course, Cheney got to break the tie.
Well, there wasn't. It's not any tougher than it is now.
Oh, no. No. This
operates like 50-50.
Yeah.
Seems like, because they never get anything done. But, you know, it keep coming up. It'll drop down to two or never see it at three place as far as what the American people are thinking. And yesterday, back on top, economy.
Oh, sure.
Economy.
Oh, yeah.
And then they have, you know, tariffs, and they switch around a bit. But your economy, I cannot believe there isn't one person that I've seen in this race for president that one person that says, we have the cheapest energy in the world. Did you know that?
Oh, and we got an abundance, too, more than we ever had before.
The reason why it's cheap is because it's abundant.
Yeah,
okay.
Absolutely.
But you do. And I said, pick up on this one statement. We have, we're going to get on our own resources.
Yeah.
That's a statement. We are going to get... Nobody would jump up in the audience and say, bad idea.
No.
We don't want to get on resources. You must be a fool. We're not interested in you for it.
Well, you know, one of the points that I've made recently is that there are some things that the Congress, even in these times, should be able to work together on. And one of them is energy.
Right.
Now, they did pass some language at the end of the year last year saying we could export, oil and more LNG, I guess. But even now, in the Senate, there's an energy bill that's been sitting there for a month. Now,
it's
it got tangled up.
What's in it?
Energy. Well, it's conservation is in there and a
efficiency
few other items.
Bill.
It's not a big energy bill.
Portman bill.
But it's being amended to include a lot of other things that are controversial, like some, I think, coal issues may come up. But it got stalled out because of the Flint, Michigan water situation. Now they've come to an agreement on how to deal with that, both in Flint and in other areas. But they still got to get through the process to get a relatively mild energy bill through. Even that is hard.
But Flint is an old automobile town, and it's got some environmental issues that they've been left with, and unfortunate. But if we were on our own energy and the cheapest energy in the world, we didn't have it at the time. Flint, automobiles, everything else had struggles and everything. We do now, but you wouldn't have those kind of situations if we'd have been
on
our own resources.
But it's not just in Flint, and because of the, you know, an old automobile town. It's in Jackson, Mississippi. It's really all over America because we've let our infrastructure deteriorate. Water and sewer and lanes and plains and harbors. That's one of the things that Republicans and Democrats ought to be able to agree on, and that's investment
you
in
should
infrastructure.
Be able to. That's right.
Yeah.
You know, I'm an old water guy.
I know you are, yeah.
And I'm an old wind guy.
Yeah.
God, it was expensive being in that wind.
Now, did you do solar too?
No, I never. I sidestepped solar. I ran out of money before I got solar. But I lost $150 million in the wind business.
Yes, that's
you could
right.
invest yeah, that's, it that's in right. me wow. a lot cheaper and, than that.
So you know what? It didn't kill the wind business. The wind business is alive.
Yeah.
Texas is one of the biggest wind
states. That's right. That's exactly right. We've had more turbines than anybody else has.
Right.
But what got me, I got in, got committed. And then, you know, wind is priced off the margin, and the marginal fuel is natural gas. So here I am committed to the wind.
Natural down gas. Down she went.
Natural gas.
Well, when I went up
$6 natural gas will just make the wind work.
When I flew up to South Dakota last year for Tom, when we were coming into land, there are a lot of windmills.
Right there,
I don't think they're in South Dakota, were they?
No, they're in Minnesota, just on the western border, right before you get to South Dakota. Oh, yeah.
The United States has the best wind in the world, most consistent wind in the world. Mm-hmm. You take from Texas to the Canadian border, and you could
That's a funnel, isn't it?
Yeah.
You could put all the wind power you wanted to there, and you know those landowners, they want it.
Do you think someday we'll get there?
I do.
I do too.
Yeah, I think you will.
Yeah.
But you have to have the fuel
price
when the wind's not blowing.
Right, exactly.
But you've got natural gas for 150 years.
Yeah.
And it's cheap. I mean, really, seriously cheap.
You know, it's so amazing. We were working not too many years ago on importing LNG. Now we're reverse engineering, and we're going to export
no,
LNG.
But you know what happened on that? That was that Cheniere plant
down
at Lake Charles, Louisiana.
Yeah, sure.
And that plant was designed to receive LNG.
Yeah.
Never took but one load. And then the whole thing collapsed.
Amazing. Didn't
take
one load.
Can you imagine being lucky enough, though, to have Cheniere plant there and flip-flop it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And now they've changed it, and they're exporting out of there.
Yeah, that's terrific.
My timing has never been that good.
It's been pretty good over the years.
You've done a few things right.
Well, yeah, okay. But I have said, and I think I'm being honest about myself, my direction has always been good. My timing is questionable.
Back to the book, I want to also emphasize, though, that you know the problem in America and here in Washington is not just with our legislative process. There's a problem across America, too. People are not voting. The amount of money that's required in campaigns now, 38% of the people voted in 2014, according to the statistics that Tom has. So we also talk about the need for more involvement by the American people. How do we make it to give them courage to vote? We recommend they move elections to Saturday. Why do we have it on Tuesday? There's a history on that, but it doesn't apply anymore.
Why do they?
It was something about going to market. Do you remember that story, Tom?
What's that? Tuesday. That was when people came to town back in the original when the colonies moved to the states. But there was a lot of commerce done, and it had a lot to do with the marketplace.
On Tuesdays.
On Tuesday.
We also think that the system we're going through here now with the primaries, they go on so long, they cost so much, It's just not, in my opinion, a wise system. Why would we want to go to a single primary?
It hires a lot of people.
You hire people, it costs money. And if somebody has to raise that money, and when you spend all your time raising money, you're not spending a whole lot of time dealing with the budget or
well,
oil
you
and
know
gas.
About that because yeah. I mean that's
yeah. So we
many,
we
too
recommend
many people
that,
kind of take
it.
For granted that this Democratic Republic is just going to be around, that they don't have to do anything. You don't have to. There's nothing you have to do to give back. And you know, part of what we talk about in the book is citizen responsibility. You either have to fight for it or work at it. And fortunately, none of us have had to fight for it, but you sure have to work at it. And everybody has a role.
So you were never in the service?
I served 3 years in the Air Force, but I wasn't in combat. I was a...
You weren't. See, I was a guy that's unbelievable. I was a little too young for World War II, and so didn't. And then we come up to Korea, and I married, have a child. I'm working as a geologist. I never will forget the letter they wrote to the draft board, Phillips Petroleum did, about how I was so important as a geologist to be able to find this oil that, you know, that our Army and Navy needed. And I had this.
You should have saved that letter.
I've got it. Whoever wrote this letter.
Well, my dad didn't serve in World War II because he was working in the holes of those ships and building ships at Pascagoula.
Yeah.
And that was considered an essential job, of course.
Sure. My dad was on D-Day plus one in the Battle of the Bulge.
Oh, really? Had,
oh, man.
Listen,
really...
one of my partners battled Bulge.
Yeah.
And he was 82nd Airborne. Yeah. And but I said, I lean on you, Lawton. That was his name, Lawton Clark. I said, I lean on you as you're my war hero.
Yeah.
And if I'd have been 2 years older, I would have been there with you. Yeah. But let's talk a little bit about, do you think the majority leader, Mitch McConnell, did the right thing on announcing the replacement of our recent lost justice, I somehow didn't think that was a good idea?
Well, you know, you put us in a little bit of a tough position because, you know, we tried in the book not to just second guess or undermine the current leaders. They're in the arena and we're not. We don't want to be in the stands throwing rocks at the people on the field, however.
So you want to dodge this question?
No, I'm going to answer it. I know Mitch well enough and I have enough faith in him that there's a backstory. There's a lot that went on in that decision maybe we don't see here. I probably wouldn't have done it. I think I would have waited. I like the old motto, wait till you see the whites of their eyes. I would have wanted to wait to see what Obama did. I think the odds are he would have and may yet come up with something that's totally unacceptable. Senate doesn't have to vote.
Yeah, I thought, just don't say anything.
Yeah, that would have probably
and
been where I've been
inclined. It doesn't mean you're going to do anything.
I just guarantee you that if it was President Bush or President Reagan, Mitch McConnell would have had a different answer. He would have had a different strategy. What happens is that these speeches now are so interchangeable. Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell just give each other speeches depending on who's in the majority and who's in the minority.
Oh, you think they're saying the same thing?
Absolutely. They're saying exactly the same thing, but it just depends on the circumstance, you know. And so, you know, you've had 13 occasions where so far in history, where in the last year of a presidency, a president has nominated and had his nominee voted on. 13. So this isn't anything new.
No, it's not.
And,
I know that.
So I'm like Trent. I think that, you know, there ought to have been a vote. It doesn't. You don't have to vote for the person.
No.
But bring them up. You know, that's part of the process.
Keep everything moving.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But let me just say that this is really, really an important appointment. Because it could very well tip the Supreme Court one way or the other, and maybe even for a long time. So, you know, I used to take the votes on federal judges, and particularly Supreme Court justices, very seriously. Most of the time I voted for them, because elections do have consequences. And I do think presidents have a constitutional responsibility to send up a nominee, and I tried to give those presidents the benefit of the doubt. The only time recently that I voted against one was I thought he had a conflict of interest, so I did vote against one of the sitting judges that's there now. But you know, this is really big.
Well, but you say this is at a critical time.
Oh, yes,
it could flip the court.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, flip the court. He's talking about to you, away from him.
See, and we don't totally agree on everything.
I think we agree on the process.
Yeah,
and
we do.
You know, we may come out in a different place on whoever the nominee is and whether he ought to be the next nominee. But that's I think what you're asking is, should that process be allowed to go forward? And I think we would both say probably. But that doesn't, you know, you ultimately have to make a decision. You can use basically the same criteria that Trent does. But, you know, there will be some who say, you know, I want a conservative or I want a liberal, and that's all I'm going to vote for on the court. And, you know, everybody can make
Senator
up their own
Cruz
mind.
Senator Cruz said from Texas.
Yeah, exactly.
He may wind up on the court. Hello?
You want to bet?
Well,
anything to get him out of the Senate.
I know what I was headed mine there. Yeah.
All right, go to the presidential race. Would you have believed? See, I say this, and I think it's funny, and nobody ever laughs, so I'm going to try it on you. But if I'd have died 10 years ago, and I'd gone to heaven, of course, and you had died yesterday, and you'd come to heaven, I'd say, Tom, tell me, bring me up to date on what happened on a political scene. And you told me, I would wonder how a liar like you could have gotten in heaven. Yeah. I mean, I would not have believed you if you had told me. Would you?
No. I mean, this has been the weirdest election year I've ever seen, and I've been watching American politics and government and Washington pretty closely for about 50 years now, and this has just amazed me. Now, I've been for Kasich all along, and I think Tom will tell you pretty quickly he's for Hillary, but, you know, what has happened with Bernie Sanders and what's happening with Donald Trump and, you know, what might turn out in the conventions and in the election, I don't know. I'm concerned.
Well, you could see your party, have a big change.
Yeah, I think we already have.
Well,
we didn't see it coming.
He isn't in place yet, but he's influencing things.
Oh, yeah.
But if he was a president, I've had dinner with Donald Trump.
Sure, I'm sure you have.
And honestly, I mean, when you sit down, you just sit down and say, well, I'm a conservative. I'm a liberal. That's not the way you start dinner. But as you talk around the table and all, I was at Ace Greenberg's home a couple of times, and Donald Trump, five couples for dinner all around the table, and it opens up. You're all, you know, exchanging. Everybody's getting the chance to talk. I would have bet, whatever I had in my pocket, I'd have bet every bit of it that Donald Trump was a Democrat.
Oh, yeah. I think he was.
Well, and I always
Of course,
thought,
he's quick to say so was Reagan at one point. And by the way, I came to Washington in 1968 to work for the Democrat congressman from my hometown.
Well, okay. Now.
So, as I learned, I became a Republican. No offense.
I didn't realize I was sitting there with another conservative, and it was Donald Trump.
Was he bombastic that night, or was he?
He always is.
I haven't seen him when
he did.
Right.
Enjoy talking, but you enjoy hearing what he has to say.
I had a fundraiser breakfast in New York City, probably in the mid 90s. I don't know, probably 96, 97. Had the breakfast. I sent all the usual list, I guess. He came. And I remember I was surprised he showed up. He showed up and brought a check, he stayed. He hung around and visited.
15 years
I bet
years
you've
ago,
had the same
experience. He was a supporter of mine.
He went both ways, always, you know.
I can say this, and neither one of you haven't done it because you're not as old as I am. But you couldn't say it. You might be able to. But I have never voted for anybody for president of the United States that wasn't a Republican. You could say that as a Democrat, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, I can say that too, even though I was working for a Democrat going all the way back to the Goldwater race. I voted for every one of them, including Nixon.
Every one of us can say that.
Right. Okay.
But now,
who was the first one you voted for?
Lyndon Johnson.
But Goldwater, 1964.
But there wasn't many votes there.
But now, I have on occasion in state elections, I voted for a Democrat here and there.
Now, who do you think I voted for first time?
Let me see here.
Eisenhower.
Roosevelt, I guess, huh?
Teddy Roosevelt?
No, I don't. I doubt it was Teddy Roosevelt.
Trying to think of the, but it would be, wouldn't it be? It had to be Eisenhower.
I made a speech in Des Moines last year, and I said that there. And the first question was, "Who did you vote for?" First, Republican. I said, kind of said, "You won't believe, or you do believe because you've seen it, what with a straight face." What people will believe that you say if you have a straight face. And I said, well, it'd have to be Abe Lincoln. And there was at least 10 seconds elapsed before he said, oh, it's not Abe Lincoln. He's old, but he isn't that old. You know, it was.
But you had to be 21 at the time, so I was, now you only have to be 18.
I was at Oklahoma State. 1948, I voted for Tom Dewey.
48, Tom Dewey.
Oh, okay. Yeah, okay. Yeah, okay. Well, yeah. Good.
How's this thing going to go?
Election?
You want to make a prediction?
I keep hoping for something to happen, somebody to rise to the top or somebody to implode. You know, I'm not too happy with what might happen, frankly, in either party. I assume Hillary's going to win the nomination, and obviously I wouldn't be happy with that. It looks like Trump is in strong position. I keep hoping that my man Kasich will have a breakthrough in Minnesota, or and certainly he should in Ohio, maybe Michigan. I'm even seeing if we can't maybe put a ticket together, maybe get Kasich Rubio to change the dynamics here. Something has got to happen to change the way this thing is shaping.
It's going to happen pretty fast.
It's got to, yeah. Or are we going to?
But do you think right now, if you had to put your money up? You think that Trump's going to get the nomination?
If he rolls the dice the way we think he will, it's going to be pretty hard to stop.
What do you think?
I think so, too. I think he's likely. I think there's about a 60 or 70% chance he'll be the Republican nominee. And the real question is, what happens then? I mean, is there going to be a third-party candidate? What happens to, you know, I think Peggy Noonan, both Trent and I read a piece that Peggy Noonan wrote about the protected and the unprotected. And there are a lot of people who don't feel like they are part of that protected group. We're all protected. You know, that we're the lucky ones. We're the so-called, you know, the establishment. And there's a lot of people who are not part of the establishment, and they want to make a statement. They're mad, they're frustrated, they don't believe Washington's concerned about them.
That's right.
And so this is the most historic insider versus outsider race you'll ever see, and we may ever have again.
But all I got to say, if Trump is elected president, I would want you to be the Secretary of Energy. Would you be available for that, Boone?
87 is, it's a little late for anything other than spectators.
You had to stop and think about it, though. I
no, I didn't. Not really. But, Peggy Noonan and I are.
I saw you with her. It's when they had the first debate at Simi Valley at the Reagan Center.
That's right. We're both on the Reagan.
On the board, yeah.
Yeah.
And she wrote a very good, you probably saw it. That Trent called my attention to it. And it's really, it's
the
it's
rise
right
of
on
well,
I saw it on Saturday morning.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the first thing I do, go over
Absolutely.
And read Peggy Noonan.
I did too. She's got such a flair with words.
She's really
talented.
She
wrote that great speech that Reagan did after the Challenger disaster about how they slipped the surely bonds of earth and touched the face of God. I mean, it was an unbelievable speech, but she wrote it and he did it. He delivered it.
She, you know, she's great.
You know, my own son called me and said, now, Dad, you've always been pretty good at picking the winners and or predicting what might happen, but you kind of lost it this time. So,
everybody did.
I guess my political prowess is...
Well, you found out that the people were angry.
Absolutely, and both parties,
sure.
Both parties better think about what we've seen this year.
Yeah.
There is real discontent out there. They're nervous. They're worried. And a lot of them are mad. I don't like an angry candidate. I want people to tell me how we're going to solve these problems and move into a bright future. But,
when experience matters. I don't know if you'd hire somebody to run your company who doesn't have a day of experience in the oil and gas industry, but said, you know, I can run your company. Well, maybe that's true, but you're taking a pretty big risk.
But, Tom, go back over people that have been candidates for president. I mean, but, you know, you go back and look, it's a... my mother, we lived small town Oklahoma. I was born in the Depression, 28, half people ask me now, say, what was it like living in the Depression? Well, I didn't have anything to compare it to. I mean, it was pretty good. I always had a pair of shoes, never missed a meal. So I didn't, there wasn't any complaining on my part. But I knew times were tough during that period. But you're born in 28, and the Depression clear up till World War II. So, you know, I saw some people move, looking for jobs and everything else out of Oklahoma to California.
More often than not, Boone, and I think this connects to what you were saying, our presidents have been pretty good. I mean, and the ones we might have doubted that rose to the occasion. I mean, Harry Truman, you know, with his background, a lot of people said he really ready to be president, but he did some really strong-willed things. When Bill Clinton defeated George H.W. Bush, you know, the governor, as the President Bush said, of a small, failed southern state did pretty good as president. And, of course, Reagan was my inspiration. I loved working with him.
Yeah, but Reagan didn't show us how great he was.
No.
Till after he got
the
control.
That's true, but he had been governor of a big state,
right.
And he had a message, he had a vision. You
all
know?
Right, I want to tell you, I remember what it was. I lived in that little town, and there on the corner, the Loftuses lived there. They had three boys. House next to it, my grandmother and my aunt were both widows, and they were raising my cousin. And then the next house was my mother and father and me. I mean, this is back to Depression. They didn't have one kid then. So now there's five boys there, three on the corner, next door, and so they have five. Those women were all good friends. Gertie Loftus oftentimes said to my grandmother, aunt, and my mother, drinking coffee, any one of my boys could be president of the United States. J.B., Bobby Lee, or Roy, any one of them could. And she'd go home, and they would laugh about, Gertie really believes any one of her three boys could be president of the United States. But my mother came back tonight, she'd say, to clear some things up, Gertie was right. Gertie was right. Bobby Lee, Roy, or J.B., anyone.
But you know, Tom and I have lived this American dream.
Sure.
You know, I was born in Grenada, Mississippi. My folks lived out in the sticks so far as we got to our house, the road ended. My dad worked in shipyard, as I said. My mother taught school. We lived in a four-room house. I never felt poor, but we were at the best, you know, low middle income. But I was able to get a good education, public education,
right.
and get elected to Congress as a Republican, which a lot of people have never even seen a live Republican, and then get to go to the Senate and be in a leadership position. That story is not about me. That story is about the American dream. It's
That's
still
right.
out there.
It's still there.
Absolutely.
It is still
Absolutely.
There. Well, Senator, friend, thanks for coming on with me.
Thanks for having us.
Good to see you. You're looking good, I tell you. We might run you with something yet.
What do you think?
Well, I don't know. Let's go for the big one, maybe.
I don't think anybody will run me for anything. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Good.